All right, good evening, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, it's great to see you. Hi. I'm Deborah Margolis, the librarian here who works with the Muslim Studies program. And we have a good number of new faces here tonight, so I wanted to welcome everybody here. And a thank you to our MSU Muslim Studies program, the Honors College, the Islamic Society of Greater Lansing, the East Lansing Area Clergy Association, and the Michigan Humanities Council for their support of this effort to engage our community in learning about Islam, Muslims, and Islamic civilizations. I'm going to keep it brief tonight, but I do want to go over the order of the program for those who weren't here last time. Can everyone hear me? Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, so we're going to begin the evening with a short lecture from Professor Muhammad Khalil, and then we're going to break into groups for discussion. That's going to be at about 7:30. We'll break into groups for discussion. We're going to spend about 45 minutes in our discussion groups, so till about 8:15, and the discussion groups are led by our graduate students who have an interest in Muslim studies. And then again, at the end of the evening, we'll gather back on this side of the room for questions and answers with Dr. Khalil, and this time we have a microphone for that last part so that we can hear from you, okay? So some reminders about the discussion period. Some of you have colored dots on your name tags, and those correspond to three discussion groups in the back of the room, the other side of the room where you came in. And those of you without a colored dot can stay pretty much where you are. If you want to go to a different group, you may, okay? You don't like the dot you have, you can go where you want to go. I want to make sure none of the groups are too small, so it's possible I might redistribute a little bit, but if you want to try a different discussion leader, you can. No hard feelings, okay? During the discussion period, I just want to remind everyone to please listen to others and give everyone a chance to speak. Just try to not to monopolize the discussion if you're one of those type of people, even though you have a lot to say. All of us have something to contribute to the discussion and something to learn from others in the group, no matter what our background. So let's give everyone a chance to participate. This time we're going to begin the discussions with kind of just a general reaction to the book before moving on to those, the script of questions. So I know everyone will have something to say about this book. Okay. I think I would just want to draw your attention to the handout. On one side are lecture notes from Dr. Khalil's lecture just about to happen. On the other side are the discussion questions. Okay? We won't have an official break, but feel free to get refreshments or use the restroom at any time. And probably when we break for the discussion groups and gather back, that takes a few minutes, so that would be a good time to take a break if you need. The coffee, I'm sorry, I forgot to turn on the coffee, so that's going to be ready about 8 o'clock, okay? It's still decaf, so. Anyways, okay, so now I'm going to introduce Professor Khalil. Muhammad Hassan Khalil is an associate professor of religious studies at Michigan State and an adjunct professor in the College of Law, and he's also the interim director of the Muslim Studies program. He specializes in Islamic thought, so we're really lucky to have him here with us.
Thank you, Deborah. Well, I'll begin as I began last time with the traditional Muslim greeting. Assalamu alaikum, and you say? Very nice. Peace be upon you, and the response, and upon you be peace. For this week, we had to read Muhammad, a very short introduction by Professor Jonathan Brown. Professor Brown is someone that I know personally since his graduate school days at the University of Chicago. He is currently at Georgetown and is quickly becoming a very prominent scholar. And the book, as you know, is divided into three chapters. The first chapter looks at the portrayal of the Prophet Muhammad. And one thing I mentioned last time is that at the mere mention of the name Muhammad, or really any prophet, Muslims will typically say at least once and at most each time, may the peace and blessings of God be upon him. Or in Arabic, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And there are variants of that. You can see, you know, in writing, it'll be simply like PBUH, peace be upon him. It's an acronym. So in the first chapter, Jonathan Brown discusses how the prophet is portrayed in traditional Muslim sources, specifically the seerah, the biography of the prophet. And he focuses on one biography, that of Ibn Ishaq, which was later edited by Ibn Hisham, his student Ibn Hisham. And what I'd like to do right now is discuss the biography of the prophet. And I'll focus on the episodes from that biography that you'll see really in all the biographies, the major episodes from his life, as reported by Muslim sources. So first, we typically encounter portrayals of Mecca before Islam. Now, pre-Islamic Arabia did not produce historians that we're aware of. Much of what we know about Arabia before Islam comes from other writings. So, for example, the writings of Muslims, writing centuries later. And with that in mind, you'll notice that I have a term here, jahiliya. Can you all say jahiliya? This is a term that Muslims use to refer to pre-Islamic Arabia, and it means, well, most people will tell you today it means ignorance, but actually, perhaps a more accurate definition would be barbarism, as in barbaric, right? So barbarism and also ignorance. This is how Muslims typically portray this period. It's a period of barbarism, of ignorance, where you have practices that are seen as repugnant. For example, people, you know, you have a female, a baby infant that's a girl, and so you bury her alive because you'd rather have a male, a practice that is condemned in three separate passages in the Quran. You have a state of warfare and a situation where raiding caravans is considered acceptable 8 months out of the year. And so this is the society that is portrayed to us in our sources. It's a tribal society. There is no government. There's no king. It's a tribal society. And it's a polytheistic society. The Arabs believed in Allah. Remember, last time, we discussed Allah. What does Allah mean? God. God with a capital G. And the Arabs before Islam believed in Allah. But they believed that Allah was a sort of a supreme creator God. And he had children, he had daughters specifically, who ran day-to-day affairs. You know, you're about to go to war, you seek the help of one of the goddesses, all right? And so they believed in God, but they also believed in God's children, various deities that assist people in day-to-day affairs. And the image that we get, or the depiction that we get, is a society where the poor and the disenfranchised are regularly taken advantage of. Okay, enter the prophet. Muhammad born in the year 570. Most sources tell us that his father passed away before he was born. Some sources say that he died shortly thereafter. His mother passes away when he's six, and some reports tell us that Muhammad was journeying with his mother, just the two of them, when she passed away, and a caravan comes later and takes Muhammad. And so you have an image of a young six-year-old boy with his deceased mother in the middle of nowhere. He then goes on to live with his grandfather, who was the chief of Muhammad's clan, for a couple of years until he passes away. And then he lives with his paternal uncle, a man named Abu Talib. And he would remain under his care until he got married. And speaking of marriage, Muhammad marries a woman named Khadija around the age of 25, according to most sources. And most sources tell us that Khadija was impressed by Muhammad's honesty and his integrity. And so she proposes to him through a relative. And most sources tell us that she was 40 and he was 25. Some sources differ, though. Some sources say she was 35. Some even say she was in her 20s, like Muhammad. But most sources, though, if you go to an Islamic Sunday school, What you will hear is she was 40, he was 25, and that is the dominant understanding. And Khadija is unusual because here is a wealthy woman in Mecca. Most of the women in Mecca did not enjoy the kind of status that Khadija enjoyed. Now, at the age of 40, we read that Muhammad received his first revelation. And the revelation occurs through the medium of the Archangel Gabriel, at least according to most sources. And it's a dramatic episode where he is told to read, iqra, or you could translate it, recite. And Muhammad responds, and depending on which version you go by, I don't know how to read, or what shall I read, or I'm not one who reads. And then he is squeezed to the point where he thinks he's going to die. And then he's released, and he's commanded once again, iqra, read or recite. And he gives the same response, and he's squeezed yet again. And then it happens a third time, and then he finally receives the first revelation, which is, in, according to most scholars, Surah 96, the 96th chapter of the Quran, verses 1 through 5. And we'll get to this when we talk about the Quran next time. Of course, initially, the prophet is confused by this episode, and he goes to his wife Khadija. She supports him. She believes in him. She's the first follower of the prophet, and she comforts him. And eventually, he begins to proclaim this message, the message that he's receiving. And you'll notice here, I have a bullet point that says, the message, there is one God. Muhammad is one in a long line of prophets. There are consequences for our decisions in this life, and there is an afterlife. And you could say that these are the three major themes of the Quran. And what's interesting is that the Arabs, the pagan Arabs, and I use the word pagan here not in the pejorative sense, but just in the academic sense, the Arab pagans had a problem with all three of these. They did not believe in one God. They believed in multiple gods. They did not believe that Muhammad was one in a long series of prophets. For one thing, Muhammad was not even the tribal chief. And the idea that there is life after death, they thought that was ridiculous. They thought the idea that you could come to life again after being dust and bones, that was absurd. And the Quran repeatedly addresses their skepticism, describing the miracle of the first life and then the miracle of the resurrection. And one reason, aside from the theological problems, the Arab pagans also had a problem with what Muhammad was doing, because Muhammad was, from their perspective, undermining Mecca. Because each year, tribes from all over Arabia would come to Mecca for a pilgrimage, or on a pilgrimage. And when they would arrive there, they would go to one of the statues representing their deity, their respective deity, and they would seek things from this deity. You seek things from the deities. You don't necessarily worship them, and you seek some assistance from them for some specific purpose. And the Meccans were afraid that if Muhammad goes around speaking of one God, the pilgrimage will come to an end. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, we now know that the pilgrimage is just fine. But at that time, they thought this was going to, you know, this was going to ruin Mecca. And so we enter a period of persecution where you have people who are abused, physically abused, emotionally abused, and you have people actually killed. The first martyr of Islamic history is a woman named Sumayya. And her husband Yasser is executed shortly thereafter, is murdered shortly thereafter. You have people who are killed for their faith. And because many of the early Muslims did not enjoy protection in the tribal system, Muhammad commanded them to leave and to go to Abyssinia, or what we now would say Ethiopia, what we now call Ethiopia. And he told them to go to a Christian king, and he told them that this Christian king will protect you. He's a just man. He will protect you. And indeed, he protects them, grants them protection. and they would, many of them would remain there for some time until years later. And this is also a period, excuse me, it seems like I'm going through puberty again. This is also a period of sadness, especially about a decade into Muhammad's mission. There's a period of sadness where he loses both his wife, Khadija, of almost a quarter century, his one true supporter and the love of his life, and he loses his uncle, Abu Talib. Now, most sources tell us that Abu Talib never became a Muslim. There are actually some sources that say he did, but they're a small minority. Most sources tell us he never became Muslim. And yet, he continued to protect Muhammad. I'm getting violent here. He continued to protect Muhammad. Why? Because of that tribal system. We support one another, we defend one another, because we're family. I might not agree with you, but we're family. So Abu Talib continues to protect him despite not believing in his message, at least according to most sources. Okay. And what's interesting is that during this period of difficulty, Muhammad experiences what is considered the most, we could say, supernatural experience, and that is the night journey. And what happens is Muhammad is sleeping one night, and the Quran doesn't give us many details. The Quran simply describes a miraculous journey from Mecca to Jerusalem and then an ascent up through the heavens. It's in the biographies that we get some of the details. Details like Muhammad's on a flying horse that takes him from Mecca to Medina with Gabriel, and he ascends, goes up to the different levels of heaven, encounters different prophets, and has conversations with the various prophets. And in these reports can be quite detailed. Finally, during this period of difficulty, the prophet realizes that he has to leave. After Abu Talib passes away, he has some protection, but it's not. It's tenuous. It's nothing. He knows that things aren't going to work out in Mecca, so he prepares his community for the major hijrah. Can you all say hijrah? Hijrah. This is the emigration from Mecca to the city we now call Medina. At that time, it was called Yathrib, and later it becomes Medina. Medina just means in Arabic city, and it's short for Madinatul Nabi, the city of the Prophet, or alternatively, Al-Medina Al-Munawwara, the illuminated city. This movement from Mecca to Medina is so significant, and it occurs in the year 622 of the Common Era, or AD if you like. It is so significant that later Muslims, after the Prophet dies, determine that this is the beginning of the Islamic calendar. This moment of leaving Mecca, going to Medina, because when they arrive in Medina, they establish a community. This is the first time that Muslims establish a community. Because in Mecca, what you have is a private movement. You have a movement that is through and through a pacifist movement. No fighting was permitted at all, and the Quran references this period as the period of pacifism. And it's a period in which you sort of have to hide that you're a Muslim. Now, there are some exceptions to this. For example, there's a man named Omar, one of the very strong men of, strong, influential man of Mecca. And when he converts to Islam, he goes out, he just lets everyone know, I'm a Muslim now. And when he leaves Mecca to go to Medina, while everyone else was doing it in private or secretly, Omar goes to the Kaaba and says, I want to let everyone know I'm about to leave Mecca and go to Medina. So if you want to stop me, this is your chance. So you have some exceptions to this. But most people are sort of undercover. Now in Medina, they establish a community, the Ummah. Can you all say Ummah? And now you have the establishment of the Prophet's mosque. There's another mosque reportedly built on the outskirts of Medina, but the permanent mosque is built in the heart of Medina, the Prophet's mosque, and it's still there. It's still called the Prophet's mosque. And what we see after this is a series of battles. Now, this book touches on so many issues, so many themes, that we could really spend the entire Muslim Journeys program just talking about this book. But we can't. But We have a series of battles, and the way the Quran presents the battles is there's a verse that says permission to fight is given to those against whom war is being wrongfully waged. So the Quran presents it as a defensive jihad or armed struggle. Jihad just means struggle, by the way. It can include armed struggle, though. And you see later verses that present this idea of a noble war, where you defend the people who are oppressed, who are taken advantage of. And you get a series of battles with the Meccans. You have the Battle of Badr. The Muslims are victorious. It's seen as a miraculous victory because they're outnumbered. And then you have the Battle of Uhud, where some Muslims disobey the Prophet and seek the spoils of war, and they leave their station, and then the Meccans take advantage of this and sandwich the Muslims. So even though it's presented as initially a Muslim victory, it turns into a major Muslim defeat, and there is a rumor that spreads that Muhammad has been killed or assassinated. And so you get this, you get people beginning to give up, and there's a verse in the Quran that states, even if Muhammad passes away or is killed, are you going to turn your back on this message of God? Because Muhammad is just a human being, ultimately. A special human being, but a human being nonetheless. And that's why today, if you go to the Prophet's mosque in Medina, and the city is, Mecca and Medina are unusual in that they're for Muslims only. When the Muslims conquered Jerusalem, they not only permitted Christians to remain there, they actually permitted Jews to come back to Jerusalem. 70 major families were permitted to come back. But Mecca and Medina were limited to Muslims eventually. And when you go, though, if you look at pictures of the mosque in Medina, what you have is, you enter from the building, the mosque, and you walk straight ahead. And at the very end, you'll notice that the Prophet is buried to the side in what was formerly an apartment. And he's not the focal point of the mosque. You know, the focal point is the direction of the prayer. You're not praying to Muhammad, right? He's just a human being. All right. So you have the Battle of Badr, the Muslims are victorious. The Battle of Uhud, they are defeated. The Battle of the Ditch, they are victorious. They build a ditch around part of Medina, and they're able to hold off 10,000 combatants. Okay, the next year after the Battle of the Ditch, we have the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. The Prophet takes his congregation, takes many of his followers to Mecca to perform what we would call a lesser pilgrimage, or in Arabic, a Umrah. A lesser pilgrimage. So there's a greater pilgrimage and a lesser pilgrimage. A lesser pilgrimage is any pilgrimage that doesn't occur during the pilgrimage season, if that makes sense. And the greater pilgrimage is the Hajj, and I'll get to that later. So they go to Mecca. The Meccans stop them. They say, what are you doing here? And they begin to discuss, negotiate, and they ultimately decide to write up a treaty. And the treaty seemed unfavorable to the Muslims at the time, but Muhammad insisted on signing it to the dismay of many of his followers, and it allowed for a period of peace. And during this period of peace, you have many people joining Muhammad's movement during that period. Now, when the Meccans violate the treaty, according to the sources that we have, the Muslims prepare an army of 10,000 soldiers, enter Mecca in what was largely a relatively peaceful conquest. You have some minor skirmishes, some fighting, but a relatively peaceful conquest. There really isn't that much fighting. And before long, the Meccans and the Meccan pagans and the Muslims become one force, even though some had not yet even converted yet to Islam. And then in the final year of the Prophet's life, you have the greater pilgrimage, the Hajj, and we'll learn about the Hajj later. And during this pilgrimage, the Prophet gives his very famous final sermon, where he calls for the end to tribal warfare. He calls for justice, economic justice. He states that there's no difference between an Arab and a non-Arab, or a black and a white. It's only their piety that distinguishes them. He states that men have rights over women and women have rights over men. And in the end, he says, he asks his people, have I conveyed the message to you? And the people say, yes, O Prophet. And he asks a second time, have I conveyed the message? And they say, yes, O prophet. And he asks a third time, have I conveyed the message? And they say, yes. And he looks up to the heavens and says, God, you are my witness. Right? And he dies in 632 in what appears to be a natural death. You get these theories, conspiracy theories of maybe he was poisoned and whatnot, but it seems to be a natural death. And after he dies, there is the question of succession. Who should lead this community? And what is the nature of this leader? Is this a religious leader, a political leader? And you have some who, you know, ultimately they decide that Abu Bakr, the prophet's companion, should be the leader of the community, the caliph, the representative. But others say, no, it should be his cousin Ali. And this tension will ultimately eventually lead to the Sunni-Shiite divide, you could argue. This moment, and really the whole Sunni-Shiite divide, it comes down to one question. How do you preserve the integrity of the religion after the prophet? That's really what it comes down to. And I don't think I'm oversimplifying. That's really it. For Shiites, or for the Shia, it's you look to a specific leader from the household of the prophet, an imam. And for Sunnis, you look to the community. And later, this becomes the community of scholars. And they are the ones who preserve the integrity of the religion. Looks like we're running out of time, so I'll quickly discuss the historical Muhammad. This was chapter 2 in the book. Jonathan Brown discusses, he mentions that, you know, we have these Muslim sources. We have the Quran. We have the hadiths, the reports of things the prophet said or did, individual reports. We have the seerah, the biography of the prophet. And we also, to add to what Brown says, we also have archaeological findings. There's some recent ones that are interesting. For example, they recently discovered something engraved that describes the caliphate of Omar, the prophet, the Omar that I mentioned earlier, the strong Omar, his caliphate, and it's dated to the year 22 after the Hijra. So there's some early inscriptions and things that we're locating. And, you know, historians feel, you know, most historians these days feel pretty good about the Quran, at least the bulk of it, because we've discovered some very early manuscripts in the last few years. And as for the biography, of course, the biographies that we have come much later. So many will point to very early non-Muslim references to the prophet. For example, we have a Christian reference to the prophet that appears about 2 to 4 years after he passed away. And we have another reference about 2 decades later where you get some interesting details that corroborate Muslim sources. And some of these have been recently discovered. And so we find that today, if you look at modern historians, you have what I would say here is a cautious majority and a revisionist minority. The revisionists are skeptical of the entire tradition, and they were quite prominent in the 70s and 80s. But these days, you find that majority is sort of cautious. They're not going to throw everything out. They'll look at Muslim sources. They'll accept the things that everyone agrees on. You know, Muhammad's in Mecca first, and then he goes to Medina. There are some battles. There's a treaty. They accept the basics of the narrative. It's in the details where you get all the arguments. And I also describe here the role of the prophet in the next section, Prophet of Islam. He is not simply somebody who conveys the Quran. He's also somebody who presents the way, the sunnah, the way that Muslims are to follow the Quran and understand the Quran. The Quran tells Muslims to pray, but it never says step by step how you pray. That's determined by the sunnah, or we find it out through the sunnah. So the sunnah tells us what I just demonstrated a couple weeks ago, right? That step-by-step process. The sunnah tells us that there are 5 prayers in a day. All that comes from the sunnah. And the prophet, and the reason it's so significant is because the prophet is seen as infallible when it comes to religious matters. Not necessarily day-to-day practical matters, but in religious matters, he is seen as infallible. Because if he makes a mistake, and he makes mistakes in the Quran, he will be corrected. There's an assumption that he will be corrected by God. And maybe I'll touch on this a bit more when we get to the Quran. And he's also a role model. So for many Muslims, the way he treats the orphans, his push for social justice, these major things, major themes are promoted by later Muslims, and even for some Muslims, the details, the way he dressed, the length of his beard, what he put on his eyes, the kuhl on his eyes, maybe the length of his hair, the way he dressed. For some Muslims, even these details are followed. And for other Muslims, they would rather they'd rather focus on the broader things, you know, helping the poor and so on, praying and throughout the night. And finally, I have here a section addressing contemporary controversies. The book touched on many issues that are controversial. And unfortunately, I don't really have any time left, but let me just say this. You'll see here it says a plea for meticulousness. And what I mean here is that it's important that we be very careful when looking at these reports about the Prophet's life. And this is addressed both to polemicists who are very critical of Islam and apologists who might oversimplify to present a positive image of the Prophet. We have to look at things, we have to look at the whole picture. We have to understand the context of 7th century Arabia, our context, think about our assumptions. We have to look at all the sources. And I'll tell you a quick story. My students know this story. When I was in Egypt, I snuck into a lecture by the Grand Mufti of Egypt. A Mufti is someone who gives religious rulings. And he was saying that when it comes to the reports about the Prophet's life, we have to be very careful. We have to look at all of the reports. We can't just take a report in isolation and run with it. So for example, there's a report that says, the quote where the Prophet says, do not eat camel meat. Or sorry, if you eat camel meat, you must wash up again for prayer. Okay? If you eat camel meat, you must wash up again for prayer. So before prayer, Muslims wash up, right? So what the scholar said is, look at this hadith. Look at this statement. Somebody who doesn't know any better would think, oh, that's a rule. You have to wash up after you eat camel meat. But if you study all of the reports, we see there's more to it. And there is, in fact, more to it. There's another hadith that gives us the background. And here's the story. A hadith tells us that one day the Prophet is giving the Friday sermon. During the sermon, somebody passed gas loudly and so audibly. And so the Prophet said, well, whoever did that has to wash up again for prayer. And somebody said, well, you know, Prophet, maybe so we don't embarrass this person, those of us who were, you know, because we were eating camel meat the night before, and camel meat makes us gassy. How about everybody who was eating camel meat the night before, we just go wash up? Prophet said, great idea. Anyone who ate camel meat should wash up for prayer. Now see the report? Now see with the whole... So it's not a rule, right? It's not a rule. So we have to... So here I say as one case study, the execution of Ibn Khattal. So some people will say, look, the Prophet executed somebody who left Islam. And other people will say, he executed this person because he mocked the Prophet. Okay? And these could very well be true. But we also have to look at all of the sources. And all the sources tell us Ibn Khattal was also a murderer. So again, we just have to be very careful with the sources. That's my plea. And with that, I will end. So let's go ahead and split into groups, and I'll float around like last time. Okay, how are your discussion groups? Good? All right. I'm seeing half the group go like this, half the group maybe not. Okay. All right. Well, first of all, one point that came up in at least two of the groups, in two of the discussions, was the issue of violence and warfare. And there's not much time to get into this. I mean, this really deserves a whole lecture. But I'll just point to the work of my old advisor, Sherman Jackson. He has an article called Jihad and the Modern World. You can get it online for free. It's not perfect. I have some issues with it, but if you would like to get a sense of how Sherman Jackson, who is Muslim, how he thinks about warfare, how he thinks about the Prophet's era and our era today, I think that'll give you a sense of what many Muslim scholars think, actually. Leaving aside the politics of the article, there's some politics there at the end. Let's see, any other issues that came up? The issue of hadiths, the reports of the Prophet's life. In the book, it mentioned forgeries. So I should just mention that Muslim scholars have long recognized that there are forgeries, that there are many hadiths that are not authentic. And the example that I have in mind, don't quote me on this, but more or less it's, you have one example is a man who sells mustard seeds. He quotes the prophet as saying, "Blessed are the mustard seed eaters." So in any case, it's widely recognized that there are reports that are fabricated. And in the third Islamic century, you have scholars who comb through hundreds of thousands of hadiths to arrive at hadiths that, or reports that they consider authentic. The reports that are generally accepted by Muslims are reports that are called mutawatir, which means they're narrated by so many different people that we feel pretty good about them. The next level would be specific collections of hadiths, like the collection of Bukhari, for example. And as you can imagine, Muslims debate which hadiths are authentic, which aren't. There are some that are widely accepted, and then beyond that, you have much debate. Because of the time, why don't we open the floor for questions?
And I've got the microphone to pass around, so...
Is the importance of hadith mentioned in Quran?
Well, the Quran mentions following the example of the Prophet. The Quran states that, you know, that God revealed the Quran and the wisdom, the hikmah. And many take that to be an indication that we have to look to the reports of the Prophet's life to guide us in understanding the Quran. But that is something that ends up being a subject of debate these days. And there's actually a group called the Quranists. This is a modern group. They're a minority. They're a small minority. But their claim is that you don't have to follow the hadiths. Historically, even those who are skeptical would still accept the mutawatir hadiths, hadiths narrated by so many different people. You know, even Sunnis and Shiites, they split early, and they all accept that there are five prayers a day. You have to stand, then you bow, and then you stand, and you prostrate. They accept these things that are narrated by so many different people. There's actually a modern movement where all of these hadiths are rejected, even the mutawatir ones, not to mention the hadiths in the collections like Bukhari and others. And so there is a movement that says we don't have to follow that, but again, that's a very small minority of the Muslim population. Yeah.
We kind of added this to our list of questions and then didn't get to it. So hopefully you can speak a little bit about the gender relations and gender dynamics, the role and position of women.
Yeah, the gender dynamics. So it's complicated, obviously, and we have to be careful of oversimplifying these gender dynamics. Because, on the one hand, you have it's clearly a patriarchal society that we're studying. But we have to be careful here. I mean, I'll give you one anecdote, one report that we find in our sources. The report, it's a story where a man is going to Omar, the companion of the Prophet. I mentioned him earlier. And this is when he was a caliph, I believe. And he knocks on his door. And then he hears Omar's wife is complaining to him. So he leaves. Later, Omar says, "Why did you leave?" He said, "Well, I came to complain to you about my wife. My wife keeps talking back to me. And I went to you, and I see you have the same problem." So Omar said, look, my wife cooks for us and she cleans for us. And she doesn't have to do any of that. Notice the key line, she doesn't have to do any of that. So shouldn't I be patient when she vents? And we have reports that say in the major hadith collections that the Prophet, when he was at home, he cooked, he sewed, he did all the things that are stereotypically considered feminine jobs. And his wife Aisha says that when he was at home, he only served his family. So we have to be careful. Yeah, we have a patriarchal society, a tribal society, where men are going to war, and you have polygamous relationships. But you also have women who are fairly autonomous, actually. After Muhammad dies, Muhammad's wife Aisha leads a battle. You have during the caliphate of Omar, he appoints a woman to be in charge of the marketplace. She is the person who's in charge of the bazaars. You have women leading men in battle. The famous story here is Khawla bint al-Azwar, who's called the Black Knight. She was a woman from Yemen. This is just after the Prophet dies. She leads men in battle and is the best warrior in the battlefield. And so we have to be very careful. It's a mixed bag, right? So it's difficult to speak of the role of women. There are many roles that we see. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was just wondering about, you know, as Islam spread geographically and as Islam, you know, changed over time, how did the Hadith adapt to, you know, pre-existing cultural traditions into the areas that it went? So thinking about that geographically and also temporally, like over time.
Absolutely. You see hadiths that clearly reflect the time and space that, you know, in which they're narrated. And, you know, Muslim scholars have long recognized that. You know, that's why, you know, they recognize that there are clearly hadiths that are, they would consider forgeries, that are affected by the context in which they're revealed or recited or related. And nonetheless, even among the hadiths that are widely accepted, you can sense some, you know, and this is where you get the debates and the arguments, but there are some hadiths that where you sense what appear to be modifications, perhaps, because of the change in context. You have, and here I have to be very careful. It's hard for me to think of a specific example off the top of my head, but, you know, when the Muslims move into Christian lands or lands where Christians are the majority, I would hazard that perhaps you would find hadiths in which Muhammad is reported doing, you know, he's doing things that Jesus would have done. You know, I mean, we already see that in the seerah, right, where he's producing food. There's a little bit of food, and he feeds many. Now, was this originally reported in Arabia? Was this modified later? I mean, that's something for people to debate. Jonathan Brown certainly seems to, he's of that view, you know, that this is something that was adopted from Christians. But one thing I want to point out, we have to be very careful also with this issue of miracles, because the Quran itself presents Muhammad, it shows miraculous things occurring during his lifetime. The Quran itself shows this. For example, the Battle of Badr, where you have angels supporting the believers on the battlefield. So the Quran itself depicts miraculous events during the Prophet's lifetime.
So you've spoken of different interpretations of the life of Muhammad and the Quran. So are there many different denominations within Islam, like there are in Christianity and Judaism?
Well, the two big ones, of course, are Sunni and Shiite, right? Sunni and Shia. And the Sunnis make up about 85% to 90%, judging, you know, these estimates vary, and then Shiites might be 10% to 15%. You also have some smaller groups, the Ibadiyya, you know, you have groups that are, you know, are they Muslim, are they not? That's something that people debate. The Druze, are they Muslim, are they not? You get these debates. But certainly the big two are Sunni and Shiite. And, of course, you also have the Sufis, and, you know, they could be Sunni or Shiite. And we typically translate Sufi as mystic. It's not the best translation, as we'll see when we get to Rumi. And you have, you know, you have modern ideologies, modern movements. You have, for example, there's like, you know, there's the Salafi movement, the Wahhabi movement, these various movements that are developed in modern times. And then, of course, you have the activist movements like the Muslim Brotherhood and so on. But if we're going to look at it theologically, really the big two are Sunni and Shiite. And again, for them, the big question is, how do you preserve the integrity of the religion after the Prophet? And I would suggest, I would argue that the similarities between the two are greater than the differences, much greater, actually, than the differences.
Assalamu alaikum. On the subject of miracles.
Yes.
The first, on page 15 of the book, they give the quotation, the verse of Quran where Muhammad, he says that I'm a man, I'm not with any miracles and so on. But then later on, as you say, the Quran gives the miracles. So has anyone touched upon the subject of miracles in the Quran and at times some contradictions perhaps?
Yeah.
Maybe not, I'm not a Quran scholar.
Yeah. Well, certainly, you know, so in the Quran, what we see is the Prophet saying, I'm just a man, I'm whatever God does, I'm sort of bound to that. This isn't out of my own accord, right? So, you know, the pagans ask, you know, bring a sign from the heaven, and he just says, well, I'm just a man. The miracles that are described in the Quran, though, are basically instances where God is assisting Muhammad. So I don't necessarily see that as being standing in tension or being contradictory necessarily. As for the reports that appear in the biography of the Prophet, where he's doing all kinds of things, he's producing food, he's splitting the moon, he's doing all kinds. Yeah, there are some people who would see that as problematic and maybe as later developments. Others see them as, you know, they accept them and they find a way to harmonize them with the Quran. They would say, well, God was guiding him, God was providing this miracle. So, but I know many Muslims who insist that the only miracle of the Prophet is the Quran itself.
I was wondering, you're mentioning the differences between the Shia and the Sunnis,
Sunni, yeah. Mm-hmm.
and that in order to maintain the integrity of the religion, the Shia feel that the descendants of Muhammad should be in charge of the church, and I was wondering if.
Or the mosque,
Or the what?
The mosque, but yeah.
Oh, the mosque. Ah, okay. And I was wondering if...
No, church is fine. That's fine.
To this day, do they know the lineage, actually,
yeah.
of...
So the Shiites themselves are divided into different sects. The majority, though, they follow the imam until number 12, the 12th imam. And they're actually called, many of them, they're often, one of the names that's given to them is 12ers. They follow the imams until number 12. The 12th one is a messianic figure. Who is in occultation and will return before the end of days. That's something that you see among 12er Shiites, the majority of Shiites. They believe that there are 12 leaders after the Prophet, and the 12th one, to avoid persecution, goes into hiding and will not return until before the Day of Judgment, sometime before the Day of Judgment. And so for them, there is no imam currently. So what do you do? Well, in Iran, what they do, because Iran is the country with the largest Shiite population, they develop a concept called, in Farsi or Persian, velayati vaghi, which means you follow the scholars of law, and they will represent the hidden imam, the hidden leader. So they actually end up evolving in a way that's, you know, not, you could compare it to Sunni developments, because Sunnis are, you have these scholars who are kind of working to develop the law. So Shiites develop in a way that's, you could say, somewhat similar, because now the scholars are representing the hidden imam, the hidden leader, who is considered infallible. Now, I should tell you, there are some minority groups that still have an imam today, minority Shiite sects. For example, the Ismaili Shiites, who, you know, the largest group is, they actually have a subgroup called the Nizaris or Nizaris, and for them, there's a 49th imam, Harvard-educated man, entrepreneur, citizen of Britain. His name is Aga Khan, and he is their 49th imam, 49th leader from dating back to the Prophet.
In keeping with the Shia-Sunni split,
yes.
at the beginning, when they split into the two camps, did they split by tribe or family? Were the Shia people who were related by blood to the Prophet, and to this day, do most of the Prophet's bloodline, are they Shia?
Okay, so not necessarily. First of all, I should stress that even Sunnis, you know, honor the Prophet's family. And this is actually, there's a big misconception that Sunnis, you know, they don't honor his Prophet's grandchildren, even al-Husayn. No, they honor them. But this is maybe more pronounced among Shiites, you could say. So Shiites, or the Shia, I'm having a mental pause. The question again was?
So the people who supported Ali from the very beginning.
Oh, right, right,
Abu
right.
Bakr or Ali.
Right.
Were the supporters of Ali
people yeah.
who tended to be related to the Prophet by blood? Was it a tribal split?
Yeah. No, it's not necessarily a tribal split. I mean, the people who become the leaders, they are from the Prophet's household. But the split actually takes a long time to develop. And really, initially, it's just, you know, it's groups kind of taking sides and not really much more to it. Over time, though, you know, a few decades later, and definitely by 150 years later, you're talking about two separate groups now. So it takes some time to evolve. And, you know, before the official split, you have people who are studying with one another, even if they disagree theologically. And the people who follow Ali, no, many of them, you know, many Shiites are not related to Ali. Yeah. And actually, you'll see them, because you'll notice them, because they're the scholars who wear white turbans. The ones who wear black turbans in Shiite contexts are related to the Prophet. The ones who wear the white turban are not related to the Prophet. And by the way, many Muslims believe that they are related to the Prophet. I was at a Muslim conference once, and they asked, who here is related to the Prophet? I think 2/3 rose their hands, you know. My great-grandmother is supposed to be related to the Prophet. So, I mean, it's just everywhere. It's ubiquitous. You know?
In our group, the question came up of how Muslim communities or countries would treat Christians or Jews. And obviously it varies from place to place, right. But in modern times, we certainly hear of wars that are going on in various parts of the world of those who want to create a purely Muslim world or country.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. Oh, but go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Okay, would you comment on that concept?
Sure.
We didn't get very far with it, but.
Yeah, well, I think you hit the nail on the head. It varies from region to region and time to, you know, era to era. And I say this because, you know, I've had many people say, you know, you hear some people say, oh, under Islam, non-Muslims had it great. Couldn't be better. And you have other people who say, under Islam, couldn't be worse. It was hell on earth. And both are oversimplifying. My response is, well, which era do you have in mind? Which country, which region of the world do you have in mind? Because there are eras, you know, when you have non-Muslims who are holding important government posts. And other eras when, you know, they're humiliated. So it varies. And in modern times, it varies in modern times. Let's take the case of Egypt, which is what I'm familiar with. In Egypt, you have situations where Christians are persecuted, harassed, and other cases where they hold important government posts. Our family friends in Egypt, some of our closest friends were Christians who were the wealthiest Egyptians I know, and they were our best friends. And I loved hanging out with them because I could, you know, drive in a, you know, be in a Mercedes-Benz, and they seemed to be enjoying life in Egypt. They had a much better life than, let's say, my Muslim relatives, right? So, but then again, you hear about the Christians who are killed and you know, hear about these horrible stories. So, you know, it varies even within each country. It varies. Not to say that a Mercedes equals good life. I don't want to give that. I don't want to be that, simplistic. But all that's to say simply that even within the countries, it varies. I mean, my father, when he was raised in a pretty, you know, practicing Muslim family, and, you know, they had Christian neighbors, and my dad went to church with them one day, and you know they got along well, and relations were fine. And my mom, same thing. Their closest friends were Christians. From my own personal experience, I've always seen Muslims and Christians getting along just fine in Egypt. From my own personal experience, it doesn't match what I see on the news, of course. It actually is bad. Things are actually occurring. Shall we end? Okay. Oh, maybe one more. One more. One more.
Okay. I might be oversimplifying, but is it possible? Would it be accurate to say that the five pillars are hadith that everyone agrees to?
They do appear in the Quran. The Quran does talk about, you know, praying and giving to those in need and fasting and the pilgrimage. The Quran mentions them, but the details, you get those from the hadiths. So the hadiths give you the details, the how. How do I pray? When do I pray? Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it's late, so thank you so much.